man. This aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the PBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whitening. I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
At arms, can you please come in?
Point of order.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us here at Sunday Times Politics Weekly with me, Amil Amrao. I'm joined by the rest of my politics team here at the Sunday Times, Apiwe de Klerk, Zingisa Mbumbu, and Zimasa Matiwane. Guys, thank you so much for joining me this week. And thank you so much for listening in, for all the viewers out there. Guys, we've got a massive story in this last Sunday Times edition. I think it caused a lot of stir everywhere in the country. Everyone's talking about it. It was written by Quanita Hunter and Kaifas Nkosana. Let's take a look at it. President Cyril Ramaphosa has been asked to help recover millions of dollars belonging to the late Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, which government sources say was hidden in Jacob Zuma's Nkandla residence before being secretly moved to Swaziland earlier this year. Personally, I'm not surprised. I think we all should not be surprised at what Jacob Zuma is capable of, with all the allegations against him. But this just takes it to a next level. It takes it intercontinental corruption.
It is going this is what like I'm a red.
And so we've had the Libyans looking for Gaddafi's money since after he passed away. This was back in, 2011, 2012, I think?
2011.
Yeah. And I remember specifically Zuma saying in Parliament around 2013 that he has no idea what's going on. There was a question asked about it, and Zuma said, I don't know what you're talking about. If there's money here, I don't know about it. Now we've got this massive story saying, actually, this was the guy who laundered the money through the country and into Swaziland. Any thoughts, guys?
Hey, it's scary, that thing, eh? Hey, it's like it was a script of a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Where in the last dying moments of Gaddafi, he said, keep this for me, brother.
Exactly.
And this guy took it and then he kept it in his banger, allegedly.
Like how Pew says, allegedly.
Yeah. it's allegedly. We saw his tweet seemingly saying he doesn't know anything about it. Those were not his exact words, but...
Because this wasn't a little bit of money. This was $30 million, which is close on to half a billion rand, which is a lot of money. Which now, I want to know how big Zuma's vault is and the results.
But you see, I mean, it's of course interesting, and it's going to be very difficult to prove such a thing. I mean, but we know, for instance, that as we were saying earlier outside this studio, that the public protector was never allowed to access the bank for some odd reason. I mean, this could be one of the reasons that there's a lot of money that is hidden there. I mean, and the Gaddafi money wouldn't be the only other money. I mean, we know Posasa and all other sorts of money. It's just that it's something that is highly probable and possible, and that could in fact be true. It's just that it would be very difficult to prove at this point in time, especially now that the money has moved, you know, from there. But we know Gaddafi in terms of the stronghold and the power that he had in you know, in Libya. In fact, he operated through that. There's a lot of money that Gaddafi spread across the world. You know, I believe that is a drop in the ocean in kind of the financial resource that Gaddafi had. I mean, and he had all sorts of influence and friends across the world. And our former president, Jacob Zuma, was one of the people who were quite friendly to the fellow, you know. So there's a lot of things that you could point to this being true. But, I mean, only time will tell. Also, the fight back in terms of the disputing, it also is interesting for me that the former president took 2 days to come to the defense, which is not also that pointed. It's sort of, you know, casting aspersions that, yeah, because you Sunday Times have reported lie about my Dubai house before, why should people trust you? Because that's what I read in his his defense. He's not saying there is no such nonsense that I took money from Gaddafi. And for him, now that he's on Twitter these days, I mean, you could have literally disputed this story on Sunday. If, for me, it's someone who's confident, that's what they would do. You come out immediately if something is not true because you've got nothing to lose. You just state the facts to say, no, actually, there's no such 1, 2, 3, here are the facts, but he didn't do that.
I think for me, when it comes to politicians sort of denying things on Twitter, there are avenues like the press ombudsman and there's a court where you could go for defamation of character. If it was me who was being leveled serious allegations against, I would use those avenues. I wouldn't just say on Twitter that no, it's not true and then leave it as that. Simosa?
I'm starting to doubt everything I've ever believed about Gaddafi. I don't know what kind of a person would give their money to Jacob Zuma, but he did. and the money belongs to the Libyan people. It's not it's not a petty cash that belongs to the Gaddafi family. So whatever, you know, recourse that should be taken or law enforcement, they should just try and recover the money and take it back to Libya, to where it belongs. It doesn't belong to Jacob Zuma. It was supposed to help Gaddafi, according to the story, if he gets arrested. Well, he died. He wasn't arrested. So now it must go back to the rightful owners.
See, the problem is, now that the Americans are getting involved because it's their dollars, you've got more eyes on you than you previously thought you would have had, because the Americans, we know, don't play when it comes to money and oil. So it's an interesting story, guys, but let's move on from there very quickly to another story on page 4. ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule has been told by the party's National Executive Committee to stop using ANC platforms to defend himself against allegations of corruption. Shas, firstly, I think the ANC's entire communications team would be used for that, to defend ANC and all, ACE and all the allegations of corruption that come out against him every week. But doesn't this seem like the party is now starting to distance themselves from their Secretary General, Apiwe?
Yeah, it's interesting. Last week we were speaking about this, the statement that was released by the party defending ACE Magashule. When the stories were published by different Sunday newspapers, including ours. So it seems as if finally the party is saying we can't take this. But it's going to be interesting then that if this is the stance they're going to take when it comes to Ace Magashule, are they going to take the same stance when allegations of corruption come against the president? Is it going to be the same case when it's allegations of corruption against any of those in the top six of the ANC?
It's interesting, because what we've seen from the ANC recently is that we get a statement saying one thing, and then a few days later that statement is either retracted or a whole new statement is issued with a completely different stance. Kimosa, are we looking at two different factions talking in the ANC here, or opposing with
each
other?
You know what, post-Nasrec we've always had two ANCs. That's something that we've come to understand. And each statement that comes out of Luthuli House, you can see which ANC wrote the statement. And now there are even allegations that our Keita Kalni House is writing these statements. And it, my own observations, this particular statement was not the first statement where I had suspicions. There was a statement, I don't remember what it was about, but Carl tweeted a thread, I think of about 4 tweets, rubbishing whatever he was rubbishing. And a couple of hours later, a statement came out of Luthuli House, and some of Carl's tweets were in the statement. So it started to look very dodgy. But anyway, look, I don't know. I think the president and his faction are trying to do some damage control and close rank in terms of, you can no longer do this thing of using, you know, the party machinery to fight your own battles. And besides, Ace already said he's going to challenge this thing in court, right? I haven't seen or heard him saying he's taking the writer of the book to court or anything like that, but that's the avenue that he chose to embark upon. Hence, there is no need for Luthuli House to be writing statements based on whatever perceived or, you know, attack against him.
Okay, guys, thank you so much for that.
Just before we move, my guy, I just wanted to add to Comrade Zim's point. I think the ANC has learned from history here. Hence they took the stance. I mean, you would remember during the years of the former president Jacob Zuma, the ANC was always in the forefront of defending him, although at times certain allegations would be on his personal capacity, and that really dented the ANC, such that to the point of what happened in 2016, where they lost a couple of metros because of mainly the reputation of an individual within the party that ended up denting the entire party. So I think the strategy now is that, guys, we don't want to find ourselves in the same situation again, such that now comrades who have serious allegations against them, the best way is to isolate them, and so that they can defend themselves in their personal capacities, not with the party, because when you defend the party, takes a strategy to defend you. If you suffer, the entire party will suffer. But whereas if you are on your own, when you suffer on your own and not the party. And I think that they draw lessons from the past and they've resorted to that. But it can also be dangerous in that it sets a precedent in that, for instance, if their president himself in the future is under attacks for whatever reason, what do you do as a party? Do you stand back and say he must be on his own again? So you see, it's a touch and go, but I understand where they're coming from, but it could also have ripple effects that are anti what they think they're trying to achieve.
Hasn't he been on his own on Busasa?
He's been, eh?
Yeah.
He's been dealing with it. You know, by himself.
No,
and
but there's
his
nothing
side.
There on Busasa to be serious.
You can't say there's
nothing
there.
Yeah, but at this stage it's too early. You must remember there's still also an investigation by the Public Protector.
Mm. Yes.
Now, when it comes to this public protector, to be specific, it's very unpredictable. Eh?
Very unpredictable. Actually, on the same.
If that report comes out clobbering him, what's going to happen?
What we expect from Luthuli House is to accept the public protector report, and that the president must deal with it in his personal capacity.
Guys, let's move on from here. We're going to get into our election coverage very soon, but first we're going to take a very quick ad break. When we get back, we're going to start talking about the last aspect of our election coverage when it comes to policy. When it comes to policy, RP was giving me a startling look here, like we're done with election coverage. No, we're not. We're just going to stop here with policy, but we're going to be talking about crime and threats within South Africa. Guys, join us when we get back from the break, and we'll see you then.
Young people are making their mark. Get up!
Tune into the Sebenza Live Behind the Hustle podcast every Tuesday to find out more about what fascinating careers are out there. You can find us on the Sebenza Live website,
or you can follow us on Twitter on Sebenza Live.
Sebenza boy.
Sebenza girl.
Sebenza.
Yavamdana.
Thank you so much for getting back with us. So as I said, we're going to get back into our election coverage. We've so far covered education, health, economy, land. Zimasa, what else? We've done so much over the past couple of months.
Yeah, we've done health.
We've done everything.
Health was lit.
Everything that's important to people, we've covered.
Because you were talking
too much. But it was lit.
The last thing we're going to cover is crime, because that's one big aspect that South Africans are talking about, and one sort of aspect that we need to change in the country. Just a little insight as to where we're going to go after this. We're going to be talking about election-specific stuff. So we're going to be talking about voting patterns, perceptions of certain parties, how they're perceived, how they communicate, and a whole bunch of interesting stuff as we get into elections.
It's going to be lit.
It's just a month away. I cannot stand people who use the word lit. I'm sorry. Guys, okay, so getting into crime. It's been for the past couple of years. Crime is on the increase once again. I mean, our murder stats are shockingly horrible. They've gone up about 6% since 2017. 20,336 people are murdered in South Africa every year. Sexual offences, 50,000 cases, more than 50,000 cases reported. And that's also an increase from last year. And your more sort of sophisticated crimes, like your cash in transit robberies, that's gone up by almost half that it was in 2017. Your drug-related crimes have also gone up. 323,000 cases being reported. So it's not, it would not be wrong to say South Africa has a serious crime problem. We've always had this problem. We've had this problem since 20 years ago. We've had this problem since 10 years ago, but we have not seemed to be doing anything constructive about it. Is it because we have a violent society, or is it a failure from our police?
You see, Amil, I think it's a combination of both. We have an extremely violent society. It scares me. It scares me a lot that, you see, just the conduct crime. Say at home, outside of police jurisdiction, if you would say. I mean, when you are inside your home with your family members, and those fights that break out, and
your domestic issues,
domestic violence, and so on. But also on the streets, you find that people are shot, stabbed, and whatnot during a robbery. And when you follow the story, you find that. But was it really necessary for the person? Because sometimes those crimes, they're so gruesome for no reason. Someone would have handed over their cell phone, would have handed over their wallet, and they're still stabbed to death, and they're still shot in places where people are supposed to be enjoying themselves, in pubs and tough and stuff. Fights break out and whatnot. So it's very scary, the violence that we subject each other to.
Yeah, I was a politics reporter in KZN way back when, and that KZN is one of our most violent provinces.
Definitely.
If you look at our stats, and just I've covered horror stories of rapes of 6-month-old babies, decapitations, burnt bodies, the horrible stuff in totality. But what I seem to pick up from the police, it is also somewhat a political issue, because if you look at the ANC, the EFF, and the DA, a lot of their speak on crime also revolves around how policing is done. So you always say, no, we need more visible policing in these areas. We need to recapacitate our crime intelligence. We need to recapacitate the hawks and these bodies so that we can fight crime or prevent crime before it happens. But at the basic level, how do you restore a sort of integrity or drive in the police force when some people haven't been promoted for 15 years? People are still warrant officers when they started in the police at in the 80s. People have not got increases for the past 10 years. Some people are still sergeants. Some people are still constables after 10 years. I mean, if you worked as an intern, as a reporter, and you did great work, and 10 years later you're still an intern, would you still want to stay as a journalist? It's almost the same thing. Would you have the willingness to fight crime? Is that where we should start?
Well, you see, I mean, for me, mostly crime is you know, as I've said this before, on most issues in South Africa, we take a reactionary stance about how do we address the problem instead of saying, what do we do to prevent the problem from happening in the first place? You know, with this, I'm getting at the point that crime, for me, in the main, is a socio-economic issue. In that, if people were
not all crime,
not all crime, but most of the crime is a socio-economic issue. In that, most of the people who are committing crime, especially petty crimes, if they were employed and had comfortable lives socio-economically, crime would be far less than. Of course, I mean, we'll never get to a situation where there's no crime at all, but crime would be far less than it is. And the EFF does make such a statement in their manifesto. In fact, how they open up their conversation on crime is that they take the approach that fighting crime will take into consideration that crime is a socio-economic consequence and should fundamentally uproot the economically developing our communities and providing criminals with quality jobs. But you see, with the AFF, they always make the right noise. In that same thing is that they also contradict themselves within the same manifesto, in that later they talk about employing 100,000 more police officers. I mean, if you say you're going to uproot, you're going to make sure that crime doesn't happen, what's the need, of employing so many police officers? But you see what I'm saying. But I agree with their first point that it's a socio-economic issue, and that in the main, if we address the inequality in our society and eliminate poverty, we would have far less problems with crimes, and then we won't have to employ more police officers and make sure that policing is you know, effective.
Look, the other indicator about crime and how the state is not managing is just to look at the number of security companies that we have in the country. Yes,
it's a billion dollar industry.
Yeah, it's a billion dollar industry. Yeah, they're milking it. So you get to a point where the more safer you want to be is the more money you need to pay. Just neighbor for the neighborhood where you live in. What's the name of this company?
ADT.
Yeah, ADT and all of those. So it seems as if really the state is not making us feel safe in our own homes.
But it's also an issue of affordability and privilege, you know, because a person who lives in a house that has an alarm and a high wall and burglar guards is the person who will afford ADT. Hence, a person who lives in a shack where you just push one window and then you are in and you can do whatever you want, that person has zero, literally no protection at all. Because another thing is... In terms of visible policing, you go to areas where someone was stabbed to death, and there's not even a road for a police van to go there. So I'm not sure how police are going to be visible when we lack such basic, you know, infrastructure.
I think it sort of goes back to what Mvumvu was saying. Sorry to cut you off, there, Zimosa, but we have separate categories of crime. You have crimes that are personal, very personal, like your domestic issues. Murder can also be seen as a personal crime, or crime of passion almost. Then you have social economic crimes, which if we had to sort out our social economic problems, it may see a decline, as Mvumvu said. But then at the other side, you also have the problems police are facing. Like you just said, in many of the rural areas, how do you say, for instance, how do you report to the police in the first place where... For instance, if I'm living in a hut, I say, hi, this is my name. There's been a robbery outside my house.
Where is your house?
Where is your house?
You know?
Well, it's up the mountain on the left-hand side of the chief's house. Because this is what happens.
That's how you give direction.
That's how you get direction. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Carry on.
But if you go to... At least rural areas are not that populated. You go to these highly populated areas where you find the number of the crime stats showing that it's bad. Because when you go to those public meetings that ministers often host with residents and whatnot, the residents come out and say, we have this problem. The police are not coming on time. They get there and whatnot and whatnot. And then you have a professional police officer who says, you know, we want to police this area. We've been saying we want crime to drop. But when we get here, first of all, we have to park outside the settlement because there's no access roads. It's dark. So if it's five of us in two vans and whatnot, we are more in danger because the criminals want the weapons. So if we can't see, there's no sufficient lighting, it's difficult to do the job. So for you to solve the issue of crime, you really, really need to talk to the issue of service delivery, and it can't just be a police issue alone.
Of course.
You know, I've attended a couple of community meetings where maybe a politician or an MEC of community safety is addressing, and what I've seen in the ANC manifesto on their promises of how to curb crime is nothing different from what the ANC has been saying all along. I don't think they have any new ideas. Actually, to illustrate that the ANC has absolutely no clue how to deal with this matter, you see how their government has failed to hold people who are corrupt accountable. Corruption is also a crime. Stealing from government is also a crime. Who has gone to jail? And okay, that guy from Northern Cape is blocked.
He's the only one.
And you see, the point that you are making, Zim, brings me to a point that I was going to make, to say that part of the problem in that kind of a crime of corruption is that if there is no political will and such is not demonstrated, the entire society, even people feel the need to go inside a shop and steal, because you say, I mean, if so-and-so can steal and not be arrested, I mean, why should I be arrested? So that entire thing becomes culture, and that is what has unfortunately befallen the country.
You guys, you know, when people speak about the EFF, they speak about Mazodi. And they speak about Mazwete, who is said to be a cigarette smuggler or a criminal of some sort. That guy, he funds the EFF. Julius rents or lives for free, I don't know, at his house somewhere. there's been pictures of them together. That guy is a criminal, according to society's perceptions. Yes, he's not been charged or even convicted. But people, when people look at him, they see a cigarette smuggler, not an upstanding citizen. And we have a respected, you know, politician, you know, busy gallivanting with that person. And then you tell me that we're serious about crime. No.
I want to start with crime from the top down. Let's talk about it from the top down. Let's talk about it at the top with the police ministry and our minister, Bheki Cele, and our police chief, who's now, both of them are having a bit of a debacle for a little while now. But that's where it starts. I mean, if you look back at our police ministry, we've had so many different police ministers over the past 10 years. You've had Ria Pieka and commissioners. Ria Pieka, you've had...
And we all know how he left as a commissioner, Bheki Cele, who now is a minister.
And not just at a national level, but also on a provincial level. Our police leaders are chopped and changed just as much as they are policemen or actual ministers being talked and changed in cabinets. So, but the thing is, what this leads to is that there's no long-term implementation, because when a new person comes in, they have their own ideas. And all the programs that that their predecessor had put in place are now scrapped and something else is done.
Do you guys actually believe that these guys have ideas?
No, I actually don't. Because
when it comes to crime, I honestly don't think so.
The thing is, a lot of these...
Because they are not affected. They are so safe.
A lot of these police commissioners, or our past police commissioners, were politicians.
Yeah.
They were not seasoned police officers.
Yeah.
Or they climbed the ranks to where they got to because of their political connections.
Yeah.
And then when you start to politicize the police, to use it to your own agendas, I mean, not just the Hawks, but crime intelligence as well. I mean, sorry guys, I'm very passionate about this because I've seen the effects of this on ordinary people. And they were all sort of dissolved out. Crime intelligence lost so much of its capacity to prevent massive crimes happening. The Hawks, they've been left in their own little state. And what it basically leads to then is that on the ground, you start seeing the changes from the top. And that's where you see the rise in crime, because we can't police it all the way from the top. What do you guys think?
Yeah, look, the opposition political parties, opposition leaders, have long been saying that the ANC administration has deliberately incapacitated these institutions, police, the NPA. Not so much when it comes to the Department of Justice and the courts and whatnot.
Yes.
But to such an extent that their plan is that if they don't have capacity, they won't arrest us.
Exactly.
So that's what opposition political parties have been saying. And then they've been linking this to then Jacob Zuma directly. Mm. But you must remember a period where we had a police commissioner who was Jackie Selim.
Mm, exactly.
That mess that happened there and how it all came together and how we got to see, these decisions that were being taken in the SAPS to close this unit, because this guy is in bed with drug lords and whatnot. So, they have been systematically crippled. Over the past, let's say from the era of Jackie Selim to what we have now. Let's hope we will find a turnaround after...
With Mr. Kestro Sotole.
Yeah.
I was going to say, with Apiwe, that's why you'll find a drug runner who has cocaine worth maybe 20,000 being arrested, but you know, the kingpin... You know, the person who is actually selling the cocaine, that person is forever going to be safe. Nothing's going to happen to that person.
And I don't think we're saying, what I wanted to make clear is we're not saying that there aren't any good cops in our country, because I think we've all in our journalistic careers experienced good police officers, experienced good investigators. But at the same time, I think there's different issues here. So we've spoken about the politics of the police. Zingisa, I want to go into what you were talking about, the social economic aspects of crime. I think And with that, I want to bring in the police here again, because there's certain things police can take care of and there's certain things that they can't. I mean, where do we start in terms of something like, if we had to start at something like common robbery or shoplifting, which are also massive issues, if you look at our stats. I think here your socioeconomic issues can come in. I mean, if people weren't hungry, I don't think they would shoplift. Or if people didn't need money excessively, I don't think they would. Well, there would be a lot less of it. Mm. Let's not say that they won't do it at all. But I think if we can sort out some socioeconomic issues, we can sort out some crimes. But when it comes to other crimes, like crimes that you can prevent with intelligence, if you look at cash in transit robberies,
yeah.
If you look at corruption, if you look at proper like bank robberies, for instance, you can prevent that if you have the right intelligence in place. So where do we start to go in terms of socioeconomic issues, and how do we start to alleviate those problems in crime?
Mm. In fact, with socioeconomic issues, where I wanted to come is the point of police themselves. You see, part of the problem we have corruption within the police is that police themselves are not compensated enough for the kind of job. They are so stretched, those guys, especially in a country like ours where crime is so high, yet these guys are so lowly compensated, such that they are dealing at times with criminals that are highly, highly loaded. I mean, if a criminal puts 2 million in front of you and say, as a station commander of this particular station, I don't want your boys to touch me at all. I mean, and maybe, I don't know how much a station commander earns, but I assume around 40,000 or so, which is enough in someone else's life. But to a station commander in a small town who wants to be a king of the town, it wouldn't be enough. But the station commanders are just an extreme. Even cops, constables earn pathetic salaries. They have a take home of less than 20,000 a month. You can barely support your family. You have to take your kids to school and all those kind of issues. And that money is not enough to do that. That is a socio-economic issue itself within the police. And as a cop, if someone comes with 1 million to you and say, actually, I will pay off all your the studies of your child, as long as you make sure that your colleagues and you guys stay away from me. So, you know, those are the issues. But as you said, we need to move beyond that. Now that we have the problem of high crime and issues of addressing socioeconomic issues are not immediate. They are immediate, but they wouldn't be addressed immediately. What do we do in the current system to make sure that it works and it is strengthened? Is to depoliticize the police system, which I think, as things stand, is highly politicized. And it's highly politicized because we have corrupt politicians who are interested in their self-preservation by corrupting the police system so that it is dysfunctional, in that they are not exposed, and then it ends up being dysfunctional for the entire society as a whole. That is the problem that we have.
I have, you know, with crime being perpetuated, let's say, by a person who has no job, is hungry and needs money, there are poorer countries than South Africa, but they don't have the kind of crime that we have. And now I mean someone mugging you, taking your phone, stealing at a shop, or graduating to, you know, hijacking and stuff like that. I think there's something wrong with South Africa and South Africans in terms of...
Are you saying there's a cultural issue?
It's violence. I think violence is so embedded in our DNA, you know, that to a point where we use it for... I don't want to say as an excuse because I'm going to sound insensitive, you know, but we use it as a reason to commit more violence against, you know, more people. Because you guys know that there are poorer countries than South Africa.
Of course.
But they don't have the kind of crime that we have.
Mm. So
or maybe is it an issue of equality? Of here we have people who have a lot of money and people who have absolutely no money.
That's the inequality actually plays a part in that. In other countries, as much as they are poor, but you will never find those that are rich in a normal way. Yes, that's the way you have a situation.
No, I'm saying not in an extreme way.
We've got obscene wealth here where you have people who are billionaires. I mean, we have about less than 20 billionaires.
Guys, Alex and Soweto, when you look at it in the aerial view,
while you are poor, you see someone just next door. Okay, let's take it, Alex, to Sentin. Those people in Alex, they are so extremely poor, and then next door they see people who are multi-billionaires and multi-millionaires. It doesn't make sense, and it creates a psychological effect that says, but this society doesn't care about me. How do I fend for myself? Let me do something and fix my life as well.
Ish. Yeah, It's a mess.
Declare, come on, man. Talk.
No, there's an argument by the Blue Party. I'm not sure if they are advancing it because their electoral support has restricted them to provinces and then to metros.
Mm.
That they can, it can be a provincial competence.
Yes,
that is instead of having it. There's the same argument they are doing with rail, by the way.
Mm.
Provincial police.
Of course,
bring a provincial police. Mm. That's the argument they are making in Western Cape, and they've got crime problems there.
Mm.
So, do you guys think that making it a provincial competency would at least depoliticize it more than?
No,
I think the problem with that is bureaucracy, because if we are to split, effectively split the police into 9 provinces, right?
Mm.
Lots of crimes also cross. Well, across the country, sort of cross province.
You always said border.
Well, cross border as well. But then you would then start to lose, I think, a lot of institutional capability within the country. So, for instance, tracking criminals, you'd have to go from office to office. This police station would have to deal with this police station. There might be some hindrances here and there. I think what we could do is have, I think the municipalities in itself should start looking at their own sort of security units within those municipalities that are away from the police. So obviously for your general sort of visibility and your general upkeep of peace and control. Mm. And then from there, your police should be called to your should be sort of dealt with in terms of your prevention of crime and your general policing.
Mm.
And then I think what should happen is that your crime intelligence and your hawks and your intelligence units should then have a sort of overarching feel to everything afterwards. To stop everything in its tracks.
We don't want 9 little countries. We have one country. I don't understand why.
And besides,
the Western Cape DA people are always like trying to create a country of their own. They were in
but
this
I mean, besides, coming to your point, we already have policing that are based on metros. For instance, we have the Johannesburg Metro Police Department, Tshwane Metro Police, Ekurhuleni Metro Police. But within that system, and those ones are coming on top of the national police to supplement on top of the police. But where is crime rife the most in these very same cities that you have got? Metropolis, because I mean, really.
Speaking of the DA, you also can't have soldiers going to the Cape Flats. You can't have people who are not trained to deal with that situation, who are trained to shoot and kill, going to shoot and kill there.
Yeah, so I've always had a problem with that call from those politicians there, because I've got a number of friends who are soldiers. And it's scary how they tell you, well, Chief, my whole life I've been trained to shoot on the upper
boots. Yeah. Imagine. and you see, this speaks to the lack of understanding of our political parties that stands by the DA of calling for soldiers, in that these people, they don't understand that we have to prevent crime in the first place for it not to happen, rather than being a repressive government where there's crime, you come in and start bulldozing and scare people. Scaring tactics have never worked anywhere. They will never cut.
But it also comes from a people who I assume live in affluent suburbs where they don't have these issues. They probably don't have solutions, and their solutions can be hard handed on those communities, because you don't want a crash, a school, and then soldiers patrolling with huge guns. Who wants their kids to grow up in that situation of that kind of violence? And like, we don't want all of that, man.
I think to end it off, I think, guys, the reality is that we have a problem and we don't have adequate solutions.
Absolutely.
We don't have political will to fix those solutions, and we don't have a general plan to prevent, to start at the root causes of these issues and fix them at there, which is scary. And it sort of gives me a bleak outlook for how we're heading with crime in this country, because there's not a plan. And even if there was, it's just there until another police minister or another police commissioner comes in and decides it's not going to work. But unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you all so much for joining us at the Sunday Times Politics Weekly again. Please follow us On Twitter, and you can, we'll all be tweeting about it, so you can follow each one of us individually.
Yeah.
We'll all drop the podcasts on there. Also, if you check on Times Live on our website, you'll find a news and analysis section or news and opinion section, and you'll be able to find our podcast on there as well. Please follow, guys, and share it along. If you appreciate our views, please engage with us as well. Tell us what you think we can do better and what we're doing good at. Some good comments will also be appreciated by us politics journalists. But thanks, guys, so much for joining us. We're going to carry on next week solely with our election coverage, obviously looking at a few stuff, articles in the paper, and then going deeper into our election coverage, now looking at voter patterns, how people are receiving certain parties, and what's really affecting everything as we go into elections. Join us. Thanks so much for joining us again. Thanks, guys, for joining me in studio today.
Well,
catch you guys next week.
Bye, Amil.